During the month of June, as we head back to some semblance of normality, we're going to be talking to healthcare workers on the front lines of this pandemic. We may have entered level 3 lockdown, but the alert levels as the community spread of this virus increases have only risen from green to amber and are approaching red. We've passed through 50,000 infections this week and 1,000 deaths, so some milestones there. And it means we've got to remain ever more vigilant in practicing the non-pharmaceutical interventions, physical distancing, wearing our face masks and washing our hands regularly, as tiresome as that is, and remembering at all times that we're doing this for those on the front lines as much as our loved ones who might be at high risk. And it's a great pleasure to introduce our first guest on the front line, Dr. Tsekofatso Gopane, a mother of three, a wife, a medical doctor, and someone with a real passion for social change in a career spanning 15 years in the health sector. Dr. Gopane, welcome to the show.
Morning, Michael, and thank you for the invite and greetings to your guests and listeners.
Now, through your position as the chair of the Black Business Council healthcare portfolio, you were deployed to serve in the Business for South Africa team as part of the National Rapid Response Team of COVID, working with the presidency and the National Department of Health. But we'll come to that. It's certainly an interesting story. Tell me firstly about you and how you came to study medicine growing up in Mahikeng.
So I come from a very modest background. You know, I grew up in a four-roomed house, which is probably more of most of the Black families. But the one thing that my parents had was vision, you know. So I was buried in books. The books were everywhere in that four-roomed house. You know, we had the encyclopedia shelf. There was no Google then that was there. So I would, they were avid readers and very supportive. So they made a lot of self-sacrifice. The only Model C school that was in that town in that year, in those times, they literally sacrificed to make sure that I'm in that school. You know, I would take taxis, but I had the best education and support system. And studying medicine was really about serving my community and wanting to save lives, you know, in a simplistic form at that age. That was the thought process.
Where did you study and what enabled that pathway through the medical field for you?
I studied in the then University of Natal, now UKZN. I did not have any sponsorship. It was really loans in the initial phase of my degree, about half of it. And eventually I was granted a bursary halfway through my studies by the Northwest government that at least enabled me to complete my studies. And that's how I really studied.
And what did you specialize in?
Well, I'm a general medical practitioner. I then diverted a bit to business, did my postgrad in business, interested in policy. So I'm moving towards the health economic space, which is really what I'm finalizing this year, a postgraduate in health economics.
You're still studying through COVID-19. We'll certainly come back to that. And it's a very interesting space in South Africa at this time to talk about healthcare at a time when we're having broad conversations around the NHI. But right now it's all about COVID-19. Now, you're a mother of three, I believe. How have you managed to balance that responsibility with your career ambitions? And I say that as a father of two lovely daughters, but I certainly don't have an active role or nearly as active a role as I'd like to in their lives because it's just too difficult to balance all of those responsibilities.
Yeah, so, you know, I think a lot of women battle. We have a lot of guilt because of how we are raised and the expectation to play a certain role. But I think from a very early stage in my career, I decided that I had certain ambitions. And unfortunately, there's a trade-off, you know. If you are looking to really reach the C-suite or business, which is where I am, you will not be able to make dinner every day and you will not be able to supervise homework every day. So that is a choice that I really made as a trade-off to say, I might not be 100% present, I'll be as much present as possible, because at a values level, I had my own ambitions as a person. But I was also blessed with a massive support system. You know, my mother has been a mother, not a grandmother, a mother. You know, she co-parented all three of my children. And I've also had a very supportive partner, you know, who was there also, you know, from the diaper stage up to now. So I think that system of having support was really great.
Do you feel the weight of expectation on your shoulders? And we often talk about this in South Africa, this issue of black tax, of first generation professionals having to look after sort of aging grandparents and children as well. There's a great deal of that kind of sandwich generation pressure. Do you feel that expectation on your shoulders?
You know, not particularly from my own family, although we come from a modest background. You know, over the years, my parents' careers escalated, and I would suppose by the time I really completed varsity, we were just an average middle-class family. So maybe not so much directly in terms of direct burden, but certainly extended families, I do, you know, have those expectations where you need to assist this one, you need to support this one going to tertiary, you need to, you know, offer this one a bit of a break in terms of the company you run. So maybe not in my nucleus family, but certainly in the extended.
Now, the last 10 years for you have been spent mainly in overseeing large-scale social impact projects in health and education under your company Tela Consulting, alongside a private medical practice which you held for 12 years as well. Tell me about what these projects entailed and what led you in this particular direction from your medical practice.
Okay, so I think broadly I've always wanted to impact community. You know, it has always been my ultimate goal. So it's a combination of two things. One was that, you know, when you sit in a practice or a hospital, which is where I initially started, you realize that you are impacting fewer patients. So my approach was then, you know, what can I do more where I go out to communities and impact a greater number of people at a goal? And that's how really the thought process was born. And I think that was also that, you know, as somebody who wants change, social change, you then find yourself in many spaces, you know, I've served various organizations. That's how I ended up with Business for South Africa. That's how I served the Black Management Forum. That's how I served Council. So, you know, it's always driven by this wanting to make broader change to society. So in terms of the projects themselves, you know, it's healthcare. Teenage pregnancy is quite a big issue in the town I reside in Guruman and this particular district. So we then had a program that focuses on empowering young girls. It's also just on the major things like diabetes, you know, preventative things that we could do, life testing, that we literally go to the most rural and offer these services to the communities.
So you really are at the coalface then of seeing how communities are responding now to COVID-19 as well. You currently chair the Black Business Council Healthcare Portfolio Committee, and you also serve on the Human Resource Council of the Northern Cape, the Northern Cape Arts and Cultural Council, and the South African Women in Mining in the Northern Cape. So you wear lots of hats. What's your link through to mining?
Oh, okay. So a lot of my projects have been funded actually by the mining industry. You know, residing in Kuruman or Northern Cape, it's, you know, it's the heart of iron ore and manganese.
Manganese, yeah.
So, So a lot of the community healthcare projects are not really funded by source private funding, you know, to support government's initiatives in terms of healthcare. So that is how really I would be linked to the mining industry.
And we know that the mining industry is going to prove particularly challenging when it comes to suppressing the spread of the disease just by the nature of certainly deep level mining, not so much open cast mining. How do you think we can better approach the issue of flattening the curve in the broader mining industry from your vantage point?
I think it can only be vigilance. I mean, vigilance in the sense that we need to be screening intensively. We need to be testing. I think the limitation we all understand that is really public knowledge is that we are battling with test kits, you know, so it offers, it's tricky that even though we might want to test, you know, the country is it's on the back foot in terms of that. But it's vigilance. But vigilance is, remember, the people who go to the mine who might spread it are coming from communities. So the vigilance starts even from the home, from the community, where with level three, we know that a lot of people are back to work. There's a lot of movement. So we need to also not let our guard down, be conscious of where our hands are touching, if they're clean, if we're wearing our masks, how, you know, the social distancing is maintained. We must continue these things.
What is the attitude like in the communities in which you're operating? Because what I've heard through various conversations that I've had, one in particular with Gigi Elcock, was that there's been a very rapid return to normal now that we're in level three. And even during the hard lockdown, there wasn't a strict adherence, very difficult environments in which to just be locked inside a shack as well. We've got to be mindful of context here. What are the attitudes towards COVID-19 that you're picking up in the communities in which you operate?
In general, my perception is exactly the same as that people have really let their guard down. You see mobility, you know, it's as if there's nothing going on. Despite the rising numbers, the behavioral change seems to be going in reverse. You know, you see towns are full, taxis are overloading. They have to be stopped intermittently with overloaded passengers. You know, you see people on the street, children are playing on the streets, which is why, you know, we support them going back to school. That's a more structured environment. So, people have seemingly rapidly gone back to normal, despite the fact that we are sitting at over 50,000 cases. So we probably either not reinforcing the message well, that people are comprehending it, or, you know, because they have not been directly affected as yet, it seems a bit abstract to them. Maybe once the numbers rise and you start having direct family members, it might seem closer to home in the way that people perceive the pandemic.
Dr. Kopani, through your position as the chair of the Black Business Council, the healthcare portfolio, you were deployed, as I said earlier, to serve in the Business for South Africa team as part of the broader national rapid response team of COVID, working with the presidency and the department. What does this particular role entail?
So I think as a chair of the Business Council, you focus a lot on healthcare policy, you know, that feeds into national policy. We participate at NEDLAC. That's really our core role. And then in terms of the pandemic, Business for South Africa is really an alliance of many business organizations, you know, under two umbrellas, major USA, which represents chambers and a whole lot of associations, and also Black business that from anyone from taxi association that we represent. So they all came together to support government's initiative in fighting the pandemic. And we are involved in multiple work streams that focus on everything from the hospital to test kits to PPE, you know, to anything that relates to healthcare, to the health, to the economy as well, the impact that the pandemic has. So amongst the roles I was given was to just lead this campaign of Courage is Contagious, celebrating the frontline or the healthcare workers.
Tell me a little bit more about the Courage is Contagious campaign. What do you seek to achieve through this? Because the one thing I've noticed, and we chatted about it earlier, is the sense now in the community that we've almost won the battle, that the curve has been flattened, and we're seeing everyone dropping their guard. Just this weekend, I saw people posting pictures in my community of them visiting family and friends and having parties again. It's far too soon to be heading back to that kind of normality.
Indeed. So, you know, initially my participation was from a business aspect, you know, but I suppose the healthcare professional in me came out when my colleagues were now having dinner time conversations where anxiety and fears were mounting, you know, as healthcare workers with the levels of exposure. So the realization then came from the Business for South Africa team that, you know, the healthcare workers need our support. The country needs to be behind them. So the campaign was really born out of that thought that we need to create a movement where the healthcare workers know that we celebrate them, we appreciate them, and they have the nation's support. And in celebrating them, we need to do the right thing, which is to stay home for their sakes as well. Because the more we stay home, the lesser of us that need to be served in hospitals and clinics and ICU beds, which is where the healthcare workers are. So really we are celebrating that courage in facing this pandemic as really soldiers in the front line.
Yeah, soldiers and the true heroes here. What have you seen on the front lines of the fight against this pandemic? I see in the Western Cape in particular, many doctors have died already and hundreds have contracted COVID-19. Are you seeing enough being done in terms of supply of PPE and support for our healthcare workers?
Yeah, I do see a lot has been done, you know, from many sectors of society that has really supported government. And I think the Business for South Africa team has done a sterling job in terms of getting a lot of this PPE to protect our healthcare workers in partnership with government. So I think most of the institutions, both of state and private, have really been covered in terms of how we protect our healthcare workers. There are still snippets, you know, here and there where you have a hospital or two or a clinic that does not have PPE or inadequate PPE.
Yeah.
But by and large, we have made great progress in the last 6 to 8 weeks.
When it comes to the social messaging, I'm not seeing like big billboards and big marketing campaigns trying to reinforce this message of the non-pharmaceutical interventions, of wearing masks, keeping your distance, and washing hands. Do you think that more could be done there? And could we rope in, you mentioned working at NEDLAC with the taxi associations. There's an opportunity there at a point of interaction with commuters to reinforce this kind of messaging. Where do you see potential gaps there?
I'll say that the potential gaps lie in that maybe the way that we message might not be relating to specific communities well. One, it would have to be in different languages. You know, it would have to also have context. You know, if you say stay home and you're referring to a person in a shack where there's eight of them, it might not resonate with them. So using civil society or civic organizations, community-based churches, might be rather more helpful, who understand these communities and the way the messaging is tailor-made has a context to that particular community. So I think we probably need to filter it down right to the community level in how we communicate, so that it, you know, people can relate to the messaging in a way that makes sense to them.
Very interesting you raise that we use civil society, because I've seen many pleas from civil society during this time to maintain funding, because they're doing such important work. And many of them outside of the food delivery and food space, because I think they're very well funded at the moment, but many others are seeing funds dry up. So I suppose it's important here for business and for government to partner financially with these organizations to ensure that they can get out there, they can pay their staff, and they can tell these stories.
Absolutely. I mean, advocacy is the first line of defense, you know, in anything, whether you advocate for people to eat healthy, whether you advocate for how we take care of our teeth, you know, so that we don't need the dentist. So, you know, you can never, ever underestimate the power of adequate advocacy in any health campaign. So we really do need to get out there and focus not only on the treatment, but also on prevention. And amongst that is risk communication.
Now, you also currently serve in the United Forum of Family Practitioners, representing various family practitioner bodies and specialist groupings greater than 30,000 doctors. And it's a task team working jointly with the Department of Health and the private hospital groupings as part of planning COVID-19 and the private sector response. What does this response entail, and what impact have you seen on private practitioners? I was chatting to my GP the other day. I had to take my daughter to the doctor, and they're all seeing a massive decline in income because of COVID-19.
Yeah, maybe starting with the impact. I think COVID-19 has really decimated, specifically the private sector. You know, I think the last survey, it was around 50 to even a drop of 70% of revenues of private practices. So they're really battling, you know, at all levels. Even the specialists, you know, who are unable to do procedures that they would normally do, their knee replacements and cardiac surgery. So that's really, it has had a negative impact on doctors across board. And on the UFFP, the main aim was really, just like the business sector, it's that the medical fraternity is looking to support government. We understand that as the pandemic escalates, the public sector might be constrained in terms of supporting patients. So it's a private sector saying we are there, raising our hands to support, you know, from anything from the admitted patients to screening, to testing, to the fever tents that we are setting up. And that's really where the UFFP or the practitioners are coming on board to say to government that we are here and would like to partner with you.
Back to the impact on livelihoods of doctors at this time, I think many might scoff and say, well, doctors are well paid, so they can survive with a couple of months without revenue. But there's, as you will know, a lot of student debt that goes into becoming a doctor. You only start earning very late on in your career. Do you think we need to be doing more to support private practitioners at this stage?
Absolutely. You know, it's some of the conversations that have been taking place. Unfortunately, I'm not really, I wouldn't be able to share details, but amongst those is really to see that the private sector is under threat, you know, broadly, because at the rate that it's going, we might find a lot of practices closed, and they might not, just like any other small business, they will not survive, you know, should they be not supported. So we do need to relook at that on how we can just create sustainability, because it is in the best interest to see these practices that are running. The state would not be able to cope with patients.
Absolutely. We already have a shortage overall. Now, we know that stress and anxiety are also elevated right now, and it must be even more so on the front lines among clinicians and doctors. What is the impact of this epidemic or pandemic on doctors and nurses and healthcare workers from a stress and a heightened sense of feeling anxiety on the front lines? Do you think enough is being done to support them from that perspective?
I would not say enough has been done. You know, I think amongst this campaign is exactly to say that we are with you. You know, it's just part of it. But we probably need to look at an institutional level, you know, having individualized support where there's counseling services, there's a place to vent, you know, a way that we can talk amongst ourselves as colleagues. You know, this campaign in particular was born out of these anxieties where every other phone call with my colleagues was, I'm worried about going to work. You know, my hospital hasn't gotten enough PPE. You know, I need to strip, you know, in the garage when I get into the house because I might infect my family. So, you know, we're not doing enough. And indeed, healthcare professionals are stressed. They are anxious. And, you know, as the pandemic escalates, so does the anxiety and fear.
Understandably. On a personal level, what drives you to keep going through all of this?
Making an impact. You know, an impact can be broader, it can be in your small corner. I normally would say all the time, pick your small corner if you're unable to make a broader impact. So for me, what keeps on driving me is that how much can I make an impact in the next person's life? So if, I mean, I'm involved in a lot of screening and in the Northern Cape, I'm involved in testing programs, I'm involved in training educators around COVID and school management teams and empowering them as the schools were opening. So, you know, that is the impact that I seek to make, where as kids go back to school, we know that I'm part of creating a safe environment. You know, that's my contribution.
Speaking of kids, do your own children worry about their mom's safety? Do they ever come to you and say, we're fearful, mom, how are they dealing with this?
They are fearful, but I think they have the benefit of a lot of information that, you know, they sit through all my telecons and my conversations and I share. And amongst those things that I share is that, you know, I fall in the low risk category. So do they. You know, my middle son said, Mom, you know, I don't want to die for education. I'd rather live and be educated later. It's like, I think this is becoming political.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are no children who are dying of COVID at the moment. There are very few. So you don't fall in the risk category. So I think I've really tried to educate them to understand that, you know, there should be unnecessary fear.
I think you touch on an important point here, and many are railing against this pandemic because it is all we talk about at the moment, and it's been called the panic pandemic. And almost that there's too much fear out there, and especially amongst younger people. As you said, there is ample evidence that younger people are not at high risk at all, and it's even questionable how much they spread the virus as well. Do you think perhaps we've gone too far in terms of creating a culture and a sense of fear out there?
Well, not really, because what we do want is to create behavioral change in the way that we do things. So we can never overemphasize the messaging. Where I find it a bit problematic is where we are leaving behind the services or we are neglecting other aspects of healthcare. I mean, you know, for example, 60,000 people die of TB. So what we do not want to find ourselves as a country is neglecting other healthcare services and focusing only on the pandemic whilst we've got other healthcare issues. So that's the balance that we need to strike. But in terms of messaging, no, we should continue to emphasize it.
Dr. Kapani, I certainly agree with you there, just judging by the behavior that I've seen around me over the last couple of days. We salute you and all the healthcare workers out there risking your lives to save ours. Thank you, Dr. Tseko Fatso-Kapani, mother of three, wife and medical doctor with a passion for social change, for sharing your experience of being on the front lines in this fight against COVID-19.